Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for January 17, 2008. This is Doug Hinwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics, and a little off the beaten track tonight. In about 5 minutes, we'll speak with Thomas Schaller, who is the author of the book Whistling Past Dixie, How Democrats Can Win Without the South. I'm not so invested in the notion of how Democrats can win, but I am invested in the notion of how to develop more progressive politics in the United States with the South hanging like a millstone around our neck. And so we'll talk with Schaller about that. The book came out a couple of years ago, but now it's just out in paperback with a new afterword in time for election season. And then at the bottom of the hour, this is really off the beaten track, we'll speak with Phoebe Damrosch, who is the author of the book Service Included, Four-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter, which is a memoir of her career as a waiter at Per Se, the restaurant in the Times Warner Center, which is, I think, the second most expensive restaurant in Manhattan. A meal there will set you back about $350. So we'll talk to Phoebe Damrosch about what that was like and who goes there and the political economy of restaurants, and also indulge in a little gastro porn, because I have a taste for that, and I hope some of you do, too. All right, before we get to all that stuff, some words about the headlines. The bad news keeps coming. This morning, the Census Bureau reports that December's housing starts, the number of units on which construction was begun during the month, a crucial indicator of the health of that market, hit the lowest level since the recession of 1991. The December number was down a very sharp 14% from November and down 34% from December a year earlier, one of the worst readings on record. The decline was led by multifamily units, meaning mainly condos, but the single-family figure was down pretty hard as well. Permits issued for new construction were also down, but they aren't yet at despairing levels. The second major bit of bad news, the venerable index of manufacturing put out by the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia plunged in January, turning in a far worse performance than anyone expected. Lingering hopes that the broad economy could escape the ill effects of the housing meltdown took a nasty blow on this news. This index, like several others, is behaving the way it does at the onset of recessions. And the third major bit of bad news, Merrill Lynch denounced about $16 billion in mortgage-related losses, adding to the gusher of red ink that the big Wall Street names have been emitting for many months now. Merrill, Citigroup, and many other household names, well, names in some households at least, are busily trying to raise money to keep their noses above water. I doubt they'll go under, but they do need to shore up their balance sheets very urgently. Much of this rescue money has been coming from so-called sovereign wealth funds, which are an interesting story in themselves. Over the last couple of decades, the U.S. has been importing far more than we export. This has had several effects. By buying so much more than we sell, we send lots of dollars abroad. The recipients of these dollars, mainly oil-exporting countries in the Middle East and exporters of manufactured goods in Asia, have been accumulating giant wads of greenbacks, which desperately need a home. Until recently, most of these dollars have been parked in boring investments like U.S. Treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. Yes, much of the late housing boom was financed by these foreign investors. But many countries have now been switching this investment strategy in search of higher returns, endowing these so-called sovereign wealth funds, trillions in investable cash managed by governments looking for opportunities around the world. And among those opportunities have been investments in the like of Merrill and Citigroup. What does all this mean? Will these sovereign wealth funds be passive investors just hoping to make a few bucks while keeping their lips sealed? Or will they intervene more aggressively in the running of these firms? Will these iconic American names, the financial arm of U.S. global power, come increasingly under foreign domination? What will this mean for U.S. political influence? Will the yahoos in Congress and the media let this happen? Or will there be more and more stories about Arabs and Chinese taking us over? With immigration already such a hot political topic, will these foreign investors add fuel to the paranoid's fire? Will the U.S., after all these years of lecturing foreign countries about the wisdom of opening up to foreign investment, shut the door it urged so many others to open? Interesting questions for the coming year. And now two totally unrelated notes. First, a little research note by Monique Morrissey of the Economic Policy Institute, drawing on work of Hillary Waldron of the Social Security Administration, reports that the life expectancy gap between rich and poor in the United States has widened dramatically. In 1972, the richer half of the population lived, on average, just a year longer than the poorer half. In 2001, that gap had widened to almost 6 years. In other words, inequality kills. And second, a lot of political progressives have been celebrating the vision of Barack Obama. Here's a little soundtrack I nabbed off YouTube, which has Obama celebrating the vision of Ronald Reagan. Listen for yourselves.
I don't want to present myself as some sort of singular figure. I think part of what's different are the times. I do think that, for example, the 1980 election was different. I mean, I think Ronald Reagan changed the trajectory of America in a way that, you know, Richard Nixon did not, and in a way that Bill Clinton did not. He put us on a fundamentally different path because the country was ready for it. I think they felt like, you know, with all the excesses of the 60s and the 70s, and, you know, government had grown and grown, but there wasn't much sense of accountability in terms of how it was operating. And I think, you know, people just tapped in. He tapped into what people were already feeling, which is we want clarity, we want optimism, we want, you know, a return to that sense of dynamism and entrepreneurship that had been missing.
And that was Barack Obama. The first part of his comments are pretty non-controversial. Ronald Reagan did change the U.S. more than Bill Clinton did. But the second half sounds like he thinks that was a good thing. I doubt too many listeners would agree. All right, let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Thomas Schaller.
Rich, what most people call a redneck, he ain't nothing but a working man. And he makes his living by the sweat of his brow and the calluses on his hands. Now, you intellectuals may not like it, but there ain't nothing you can do. Cause there's a whole lot more of us common folks than there ever will be of you. What this world needs is a few more rednecks. People ain't afraid to take a stand. What this world needs is a little more respect for the Lord and the law and the working man. We can use a little peace and satisfaction. The good people up front take the lead. Need a little less talk and a little more action. And a few more rednecks is what we need. That's what we need. And a few more rednecks is what we need.
And that was the Charlie Daniels Band in their classic anthem of redneck political self-identification. What the world needs is a few more rednecks. A couple of people who are not afraid to take a stand. And I thought that was a good setup for Thomas Schaller, who would be on the line if you hadn't given us a new phone number to call. So while we wait to make connection with him, let me say he is the author of the book Whistling Past Dixie, How the Democrats Can Win Without the South, a book that came out a couple of years ago but is just out in paperback from Simon & Schuster. And Thomas Schaller is an associate professor of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, a columnist for the Baltimore Sun. And you hear a lot of pundits say, and you can even read this in the Nation magazine, that Democrats can't win without attracting the South. Thomas Schaller says that's not true. So now we have him on the line. Welcome to Behind the News, Thomas Schaller. I'm very good.
Sorry for that phone problems. I just got my new iPhone today, but I'm having all kinds of problems.
Okay, well, now everything is settled down. We back after the 2004 election, there's a email polemic that circulated on the internet whose title was F, the word we can't say on air, the South, and it was a very spirited polemic. Actually, a friend of mine who's an editor tried to get the author of that to write a book, but that didn't work out. But you've actually written something which is a more considered and sober version of that polemic. You hear, like, you even read this in the pages of The Nation magazine, the Democrats can't win without the South. You don't think so, right? Why not?
Well, I think I don't say that they can't win with the South. I'm just saying that they can win without it. And I think the 2006 elections vindicated my book's basic argument. The Democrats have been slowly losing seats in the South since the Civil Rights era, but they've been gaining outside the South. And in 2006, they won 85% of their new seats outside the South. 5 out of 6 governors, 5 out of 6 U.S. senators, 24 out of 30 House members, and 90-plus percent of state legislators, and all 10 of the state legislative chamber majorities they captured were outside the South in 2006. And normally, when the Democrats do so poorly in the South, they do poorly nationally, as they did, say, in 1980 or 1994. And when they do well in the South, they do well nationally, historically, in, say, 1976 or 1986. But 2006 marked a turning point. It was the first time the Democrats did poorly in the South and yet did well nationally, capturing majorities at every single level of government. We now have a majority of governors, U.S. senators, U.S. House, and state legislators and state legislative chambers. And so that's exactly as I forecast in the book in 2006.
Well, what portion of this, the national population and, more importantly, the Electoral College, does the South represent?
It depends on how you measure it. In my book, I stick to the 11 Confederate states. Some people like to add Missouri, and some people like to add Kentucky, and some people like to add Oklahoma. But if you use the 11 former Confederate states, it's about 31% of the population and a little bit about roughly that share of House seats and a slightly smaller share of Senate seats because, you know, the small states each get two. So it's just a little under a third, and it soon will be more than a third. Those states are still growing, particularly Florida and Texas, Georgia, North Carolina.
Well, if we go back to 1968, Richard Nixon devised his Southern strategy. That really was, in many ways, the beginning of the rise of the South to the present form of its political dominance. It always had a strong position in Congress because of the seniority of so many of its representatives. But you know, this role of the South is a very conservatizing force in American politics. You know, we can trace at least the modern form of it to the 1968. What is it about the South that gives it this almost unique quality in among the American regions?
Well, there are a lot of factors, but the two that you can't really get around are obviously race and unionization, in my view, and religion, of course, probably those three. And the South is the most racially polarized region of the country. It's the least unionized region of the country, and it's obviously the most religious and more specifically evangelized region of the country. And so, you know, the basic premise of my book is why would the Democratic Party, which is the more liberal or progressive of the two parties, I don't think anybody would dispute that, why would it begin to reconstitute itself, rebuild itself in this sort of 49-49 America with very, you know, evenly divided parties by going to the most conservative region and the most conservative states and the most conservative voters, which are in the Southeast? And the historical reasons are probably too deep to get into. I talk a lot about them in the second chapter of the book, but you know, the third chapter, you know, but the long and short of it is that, you know, after the Civil War, you know, the South became the only region of the country that's really lost a war, and it sort of redoubled down in terms of being culturally autonomous, and so the South's political culture is very conservative, and we see that in a lot of ways still to this day, you know, the most conservative attitudes on abortion or on school prayer or on, you know, interracial marriage are among white Southerners. And then, obviously, you know, the racial issue post-slavery, you know, is still very, very real in the South. You know, one of the most amazing things, and I report this in the book, is that in 2004, among white Southerners, attitudes on abortion did not correlate. They did not predict voting among white Southerners for president in 2004. Attitudes on national defense did not in any way correlate statistically with voting for president in 2004. But attitudes on race, negative attitudes on race, were statistically significant and positively related to Republican voting. And that's in 2004, not 1904. 2004, negative attitudes on race were correlated and associated with voting Republican in 2004, and that's just a fact.
Well, if we go back to Nixon and his Southern strategy, that was what it was all about. Kevin Phillips, the architect of it, said the key to politics was who hates whom, and they certainly learned how to play on that.
Yes, that's exactly right. You know, and I modeled my book in many ways off Mr. Phillips' book, and he wrote a nice blurb for my book. And, you know, he saw that the Republicans could use the race issue and cultural issues, not just race, that's an overstatement, but race and cultural issues to turn the Democratic South, which had been Democratic essentially since the era of Jackson, with the exception of the Reconstruction period after the war when Union troops were down there forcing Republican control. But basically, the Democratic and the most Democratic region in the country could be flipped using race and cultural issues, and they've successfully done that. The Southern strategy has worked. It took a long time to get there. It took about 35 years. Nixon only won the presidency, but not the Congress. Reagan won the presidency and the Senate, but not the House. Then the Republicans won both the Senate and the House in 94, but not the presidency. And then by 2000, they had won everything on the national level, and they did that through the strength of converting or defeating in primaries or general elections Democrats in the South. Well, that's great. And what's happened now and what we saw in 2006 is a conversion of the Northeast and the Midwest. where Ford and Rockefeller-style moderate Republicans lost their seats in 2006. Some of the most liberal Republicans in the Congress, with the exception of Chris Shays, all the Republicans in the Northeast, for example, are now gone. There's only one Republican member of the House of Representatives out of 22 seats in the Northeast, and there's only five or six in New York. So out of New York and New England, you have about 51 seats in the Congress, and only six are Republicans. So what's happened to the South in converting Democrats, Dixiecrats, into Republicans is now happening to a lesser degree in the Northeast and the Midwest, converting moderate Rockefeller, Ford, sort of Dole-style Republicans, Romney-style Republicans into Democrats. And so that's what's giving the Democrats the ballast to build their national majorities outside the South.
And, of course, Romney himself is converting himself into God knows what.
Yeah, I know. I like to call him Jukebox Mitt, because you just wait every 4 minutes and the tune changes.
He was a Michigander on Monday, and by Wednesday he hadn't lived in Michigan in 30 years. So
right, and he's South Carolina. He's down there eating corn pone and going to fish fries like he's grew up his whole life there.
I was speaking with Thomas Schaller, professor of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and also author of Whistling Past Dixie, just out in paperbacks from Simon & Schuster. Before I go on, I do want to ask you what you make of the Thomas Frank thesis in What's the Matter with Kansas, that Republicans have been very successful in getting white working-class voters to vote against the material interest with the cultural issues.
I know Tom, and he's a good friend of mine, and I agree on most of the stuff of the book. I do disagree slightly with his thesis in this regard. You know, what Tom is saying is that, you know, people are voting against their economic interests, and that presumes that they're not voting for their social and cultural issues, and of course they are. And so the question is not whether they're voting against their economic issues. It might be that they weigh the social and cultural issues more, that they are torn, that they do want a sort of an FDR-style economic populist paired with a socially conservative sort of anti-choice, anti-busing, anti-segregation, anti-political correctness, but they don't find a party that can offer both of those things, and so they're conflicted. And one of the things I say in the book is that it may simply be that people feel that they can get that delivered by the government, that the government and only the government can, say, pass a law outlawing abortion, but the government can't pass a law making you independently wealthy, and that people simply think, well, I have more control over my economic situation than I do over the political and moral compass of the nation, so I'm going to vote my social issues over my economic preferences. So I'm not really voting against them. I simply, the salience or the weight of the social and cultural bundle of issues means more to me. And I, more to the point, I think my votes can actually matter in that regard, whereas I can't simply vote myself economic prosperity. So it's a slight, distinction that I make from the Frank thesis, but essentially he's right that there are people who are conflicted with both parties because they find one party that's offering them the bundle on social and cultural issues they like, but not on economics, and then vice versa.
All right, now returning to geography. Gallup reported the other day that people self-identifying as Republican, lowest share in a very long time. And it's looking more and more like the Republicans are becoming isolated as a southern party and not doing so well in the rest of the country. Is that your perception?
That's not only my perception, but frankly my wish. I mean the book calls for reversing the maps, the famous maps, strangely enough, that Karl Rove talked about in 1896 and 1900, those McKinley elections over William Jennings Bryan. If you go back and look at those maps, Democrats in the early part of the 20th century would win the South, but win nothing else. Teddy Roosevelt didn't. Go look at the maps where he won. Go look at the maps McKinley won. Go look at the maps that, like, Warren Harding won. They would win 65 or 70% of the electoral votes, which would be considered a huge landslide compared to Bush, who got barely 50% of the electoral votes in the last two elections, and they didn't win any of the South. And so when people say, well, you can't concede the South and still win, that was the Republican formula for 72 years from the Civil War until the New Deal for four generations, 72 years, 18 presidential elections. The Democrats only won four out of 18 presidential elections despite dominating the South. And in none of those four elections, two by Cleveland non-consecutively and two by Wilson consecutively, in none of the four wins did they get above 50% of the vote. It's incredible. In a 72-year period, the only Democrat who got above 50% of the popular vote was in 1876, Sam Tilden, and they cheated him out of the White House. So the notion that you can win without the South being a farce is just absurd when people suggest that it can't be done, because it was done for 72 years by the Republicans. And when people say, well, the South is bigger today, that is simply not true either. The first chart I put in the book is the percentage of electoral votes cast by the South from 1880 to today, and it's basically hovered from 27% to about 31 or 32%. As the Northeast and the Midwest have shrunk, the West has grown and picked up the slack. And so the South basically cast the same share of electoral votes as it did 100 years ago, and it actually has fewer senators since we've added states out west. So, you know, the South's clout is not much bigger than it was at the turn of the 20th century. And so if the Democrats could be beaten by making them a Southern-only party, the Republicans could very well be beaten by making them a Southern-owned party, and I think increasingly that's what's happening. I'm hopeful, frankly, that Mike Huckabee is the nominee because I think he'll win the South, maybe some border states and a couple of states in the Mountain West, but I don't think he can win the coast or the Southwest or the Midwest or the Northeast, and he could come away with, you know, 30 or 40% of the electoral votes and lose the White House.
Well, it always seemed to me that if you look at population, the coasts plus the upper Midwest and maybe Colorado or something like that, you're talking a very substantial portion of the American population. So is that the kind of geographic base of the of this new Democratic coalition you're thinking of?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the last couple of elections, basically Al Gore and John Kerry started with about 250, 260 electoral votes, and where did they get them? Mostly in the Northeast, the upper Midwest, the coastal states. And so, you know, you're not very far from building a majority, and, you know, that's the starting point for the coalition. Now, some of those states are shrinking. You know, the New Yorks and the Pennsylvanias and Ohios, they continue to lose population, and every census they lose, a seat or two in Congress. And states like Florida and Georgia and Texas are gaining, but so are the western states. I mean, the Southwest states and California over the next 30 years are going to pick up 12 electoral votes, and the Southeast states are going to pick up 19 electoral votes. So if you can win the Southwest and hold on to California, even if you lose the Southeast, you're talking about electoral strategy built around 7 electoral votes over the next 30 years. When people say you can't win without the South, it's absurd. They're gaining population, but so is the interior West, and so is the coastal West. And so, you know, it would be absurd to change your entire party around and start to run around, you know, trying to be NASCAR Democrats and talking religion and talking and compromising yourself on social and political and cultural positions for the sake of 7 electoral votes when you came within one state, Al Gore, New Hampshire, 4 electoral votes, forget Florida, and John Kerry came within one state of Ohio despite losing the popular vote by 2.5 points. So when people say the Democrats can't win without the South, Bill Clinton got more than 270 electoral votes both elections. He got some southern states, but he didn't need them. Al Gore came from one state from building a non-southern majority, and so did John Kerry. So in the last 4 elections, the Democrats are 2-2 and basically lost in overtime twice. I mean, it's very doable when you take the Pacific Coast, the Northeast, the Midwest, and the Southwest, and you pair that together, and that puts you at about 330 electoral votes.
And what about Florida?
Well, Florida I treat differently in the book, and this is a great question because Florida is different from the rest of the southern states, and though I count it in those calculations, like when you ask me what percentage of votes are in the South, I include Florida in their electoral votes, but I treat Florida separately in one of the late chapters of the book because Florida is unique, and the reason it's so competitive is why? Because it's the least southern of the southern states. It's the most populated with non-native southerners. In fact, when you look across the South, Doug, what's fascinating is look at the areas where Democrats do well. They do well in the research triangle of Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. They do well in college towns like Athens and Austin. They do well in places in like Northern Virginia, right across the river from where I am right now, which is 15% Asian American Northern Virginia, which helped elect Jim Webb and his Asian American wife. The places where Democrats are most competitive in the South are the places with the least native Southerners in it, because people have moved down there, either because they're bluebirds who've retired to the I-4 corridor between Tampa and Orlando, or because they moved to Washington, D.C., which is the third biggest tech region now in the country after San Francisco and San Jose, and they've moved to Northern Virginia. And so non-native Southerners are repopulating the South, and those are the areas that eventually will tip states like Virginia and are already tipping states like Florida into the blue column. My only point in counter to that is build your majority first and then take your governing majority, govern successfully, and appeal to the South and start to flip the states.
It seems like Virginia has changed a lot since I spent 3 years in Charlottesville at UVA in the late 1970s. Then it was really...
It's incredible how much Virginia has changed, particularly Northern Virginia. The counties are growing like exponentially in population.
Well, that's something I've always wondered. As a lot of these states become more urbanized, won't their politics change?
Yes, their politics will change. And I think, you know, the other thing that can be said is that some of the generational burdens of the Southern history, and by the way, you know, racism is not limited to the South. You know, it doesn't end at the Mason-Dixon line. But some of the generational problems that have plagued the ability of, say, blacks and whites to vote in coalition in the South, Those things are starting to change in the South, too. Interracial marriage rates are going up across the country, a little slower in the South than the rest of the country, but going up in the South as well. And I think as older generations are replaced by a younger generation, the burdens of Southern history and the conservative drag that is created by Southern history will become more and more faint. I mean, the South is less distinct from the rest of the country today than it was 30 years ago, and it'll be less distinct, maybe even indistinguishable, from the country in 30 or 40 years from now. My only point is, do you want to wait 30 or 40 years until the country is pretty uniform across all the regions to build your majority? And I don't think a lot of Democrats, and certainly not a lot of liberals and progressives like myself, want to wait 30 or 40 years to build a majority and all the costs and all the damage and unnecessary wars and overspending and military contracting and destruction of civil rights that would happen in the next two generations. They want their majority now. And so my point is really, my book is really about, it's an argument of efficiency. It's an argument of strategy. How do you build your majority in the short term to get above 51%? Figure that out, then work for 55%, then work for 60%. And in the short term, the way to build a majority is to convert the Midwest and convert the Southwest, build your majority, govern successfully, and then go after the border South, and then ultimately go after the Deep South, which is the hardest region for the Democrats to really appeal to.
Well, in the couple of minutes we've got left, what about the substance of this? Because every time a Democrat would lose an election, we'd hear the DLC come out and say, you know, we need gods and guns and appeal to the Southern Bible thumpers, basically. What kind of platform do you see as a winning one to cement this new geographic majority you're thinking of?
I talk about this a little bit in chapter 6 of the book, and I try to come up with sort of a Democratic Party elevator pitch, you know, because the Republicans, say whatever you want about them, they're very concise and very clear. You know, they claim to be, at least, the party of strong national defense and low taxes and small government and traditional family values. So what is the Democrats, you know, 30-second elevator pitch? And in the book, I say, you know, the Democrats should present themselves as a party that is strong on defense, but also strong on offense. In other words, that we're not afraid to engage the world in an important way, in a humanitarian way, but not in an aggressive way. And that's sort of in the contrast of this sort of preemptive war. They should believe in expansion of the inalienable rights of all citizens. And this is a sort of an umbrella term that covers everything from sort of gay rights and women's rights and equal rights and workers' rights and so forth. And then on the economy, a culture of investment, which sort of steals the Republican language. They like the culture of life and so forth, and use the investment term. And this is where Bill Clinton was really strong, talking about building a bridge to the 20th century, that the Democrats are the party that doesn't just spend the money as they have it, in fact, not spend more money than they bring in revenues, and invest in institutions, whether it's schools or it's infrastructure or whether it's communities that pay off in the long term, instead of just blowing money like a drunken sailor, as John McCain is saying on the campaign trail right now. So a culture of investment, strong on defense, but strong on offense too, and defense of inalienable liberties, and sort of you can appeal to a broad-based coalition that's female-led, that's multiracial, that's union-based, that's generally secular, that's somewhat younger, and somewhat suburban and inner suburban and urban in its demographic composition. And there's a majority to be built with that platform in those demographic areas. In those demographic groups in the regions that I spoke of, the Northeast, the Midwest, the Southwest, and the coastal Pacific Coast West.
That sounds like a good strategy, but that would have to be a long elevator ride to get that.
I butchered a little bit. Yeah. I was explaining.
But condense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. Interesting book. I've been speaking with Thomas Schaller, who is the author of Whistling Past Dixie, How Democrats Can Win Without the South, just out in paperback with a new afterword from Simon & Schuster. All right. Let's take a break for station ID.
Only two things scare me, and one is nuclear war.
What's the other?
Excuse me?
What's the other thing that scares you?
Hi, this is Jamie.
Hi, this is Sarah from Brand Van 3000, and you're listening to
WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York. See how relaxed you're getting?
Indeed.
And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial in the New York area, but also on the web around the world at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, and let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Phoebe Demarache.
¶¶
And that was a bit of Pierre Boulez's first sonata for piano, performed by Pi Hsien Chen. We're now joined in the studio by Phoebe Damrosch, who had a several-year career as a waiter. Or what's the gender-neutral term? Do we say waiter?
I say waiter.
Waiter. Server was a little funny, and waitron is comical, so let's go with waiter. Per Se, I think is the second most expensive restaurant in Manhattan, right, according to Zagat. An author of the book Service Included, 4-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter. There it is in the subtitle, which is published by William Morrow. And actually, I got this book for Christmas, and I started reading it right away and enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
There are many things that interest me about that. First, of course, is the food just sounds absolutely splendid. Per Se, tell us the history of Per Se and Thomas Keller.
So the chef of Per Se is Thomas Keller, who also owns the French Laundry in the Napa Valley and Bouchon and Bouchon Bakery in Vegas and California and now here. And it's a, you know, really extravagant menu of 9 courses, and the reservations are taken exactly 60 days in advance. So I always feel like I have to explain a little bit about it. Now, I think the price of the menu just went up to $275 per menu. Yep. So that's,
Zagat says something like $325 or $350 is the average price.
Well, yeah, you know, because it's service and food, but if you're going to be drinking wine, which most people do, then it, you know, goes up quickly.
And the neighbor, is it Masa? Is actually
Masa's
the most
expensive.
Most expensive,
that's
close,
right,
to $500 a pop. That's just
right,
extraordinary. But maybe someday I'll save my pennies. Now what does someone get for $350 in a visit to Per Se?
Well, you know, it's a lot of luxury. You have, when you order truffles, more truffles than you've probably ever seen in your life, and more foie gras and more caviar. It's just, you know, it's sort of this sumptuous feast. And it goes on for a long time. I mean, the average meal, I think, takes around 3 hours. So you can get out of there more quickly, but you really, you know, it's
why would you want
experience
to?
Exactly. And what I like to think of is really impeccable, flawless service that's not pretentious or stuffy. In a view of Central Park. It's a pretty majestic experience.
Why is it so expensive? I mean, how much is the ingredients, how much is the labor, and how much of it is Thomas Keller fattening his own wallet?
Actually, I don't think high-end restaurants make very much money. Most of the high-end restaurants you see will also have a kind of lower-end line, or, you know, the chefs have some other way of making a lot of money because the cost of the ingredients is really, really high. Plus, you have this huge team of people in the dining room and then also in the kitchen that you're supporting. You know, plus it was I think $12 million building. So in some ways, you know, still paying that back. Because there are only 16 tables, there's often only, you know, 80, 90 people per night. So it's not like it seems like you're going to make a huge amount of money, but really with the amount of people that are actually coming and the amount you're spending on the meal, the restaurant spending on the meal, it's really a pretty small amount that you're making.
Yeah, I was amazed at the size of the army of people who produce, 80 or 90 meals a night.
It really is.
How many people? I mean, give us an idea of the structure of how a room like this is set up.
You mean in terms of who's working?
Yeah, who's working.
Well, in the service, we would be divided into stations, and the waiter would have 4 tables, but then it would be a waiter, a back waiter, a bunch of runners, coffee servers. So it's really an army of people. And in the kitchen, it's even more. And then, you know, even the people that you're seeing just cook the food, then there's also an army of dishwashers and a whole bunch of bakers and a person, you know, some people who just make chocolate. And, you know, it's people who are just making stock.
Now, is it true that there's a chocolate room kept at 62 degrees?
I think it's 62. It's in the 60s, and it's a special, very, very special room in many ways.
I was intrigued also by the news that Keller flew out the dishwashing staff from the French Laundry to train the dishwashers in New York. What are the unique skills of washing dishes that, per se, that require special training?
Well, some of the dishes are hundreds of dollars a piece, I believe. So, you know, you can't have someone you just pick up off the street who's a little bit careless. They require very special skills, I guess. And also, I think it was kind of a sign from him that he was willing to put a certain amount of training and expertise into every single level of the restaurant, not just the most visible and important ones. Even the dishwashers are important in the team.
Now, someone who is waited on it, per se, like you mentioned the waiter, the captain, and the back server structure. This is very interesting, that the captain is kind of the most visible person. Who, what does the captain do?
Captain is kind of like a waiter in other restaurants. So, you know, responsible for taking the wine order and making sure everything goes smoothly, taking the food order. And because there's so much food coming out and so many courses, there's kind of a lot of, stage managing to do on the part of the waiter. And then he or she will work with a back server who's the person that makes sure the bread and the water gets there. And there's a lot.
That's the person who's really running around doing a lot of work, right?
Exactly.
Bread, refilling water, and just moving things in and out.
I think everyone, no matter where you go, I mean, if we're talking Applebee's here, it's the same way. Some people want service that's really overly familiar. And oftentimes those would be the people that would take up a lot of your energy as a captain, because you'd be, talking and really conversing and really a part of these people's experience. And some people want very hands-off service, and you'd maybe stay away from them a little bit more. So I think one of the big roles of the captain is trying to figure out what's going to make each person comfortable in a restaurant.
And then the runners, what are they all about?
Runners bring the food from the kitchen to the dining room. And because usually the kind of person, this is not only always true, but a lot of times the kind of person that comes in per se is very interested in food, and so the runner will know almost everything. Hopefully everyone in the restaurant knows everything, but especially the runners know almost everything about the food. So if the person asks, you know, I see there's a little bit of yellow powder on the side of this plate. What is that? And the person running the food will be able to tell them that it's dehydrated carrot powder.
Dehydrated carrot powder. That's and the kitchen, it was 5,000 square feet, I think you said?
It might even be larger. I mean, there's the first kitchen that you walk into where the food is prepared. Then there's another kitchen behind for private dining. And then there's a kitchen just for making stock. And then in the back, there's the bakery and the chocolate room and the pastry room. So it just goes on and on.
And this is some of the priciest real estate in the world.
Exactly.
We're talking about 5,000 square feet or more dedicated to...
That's right. The kitchen is much, much larger than the dining room, which is, you know, a statement in itself, because most restaurants have itty-bitty kitchens and huge dining rooms.
Yeah. And now, I almost said he for the captain. You, of course, were a captain and you're not a he, but you're about the only one, right?
When I was there, I was the only female. There were two women who came in and out, and... it's a really pretty male-dominated society, high-end dining. I think that's changing a little bit. But it was such a funny
thing
to me.
Why is that? Is it 'cause, like...
It's so bizarre to me, because you'd think that hospitality and service is kind of women's work. So it was sort of an inversion of an inversion, that I thought that this is a strange thing for me to be a woman in a man's role, and yet it seems like a sort of traditionally feminine role.
But you dress mannishly.
But I wore a suit and tie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it drove me crazy. And, you know, I'm starting to see some changes around the city, and La Bernardin just hired their first female captain, which is really wonderful. And even more interesting, I think, is the racial breakdown in a lot of restaurants. And it would be very interesting to see if customers started to demand more and waiters started to demand, the people who have been bussing tables, you know, people from Bangladesh, people from Mexico, to actually see them be able to move up in the ranks.
Yeah, it almost seems that there's this ethnic hierarchy in restaurants, regardless of the price range that the restaurant is.
Yeah, I think there probably was less at per se, because it sort of brought the kind of person that was really interested in being in the food industry, someone who wanted to start his or her own restaurant and stuff like that. So people, you know, someone who was maybe college educated might be willing to run coffee at per se just for the experience and have it on their resume, whereas a lot of restaurants, that wouldn't be the case.
Well, yeah, you have a couple of fancy names in your background, like what, Columbia and Sarah Lawrence, right? So
that's, right.
Not what one thinks of as preparing one for a career in waiting.
It's true. Yep.
How many folks were there like you at
many,
per se?
Many people. And a lot of people had been to culinary school and so, you know, knew the kitchen but were choosing to work in the front of the house just to have that experience before they went off and did their own thing.
Yeah, that's actually something I wanted to talk about, the structure of the kitchen, because there are people who, and I think there was a New York Times article about this a while back, people who go to culinary school end up deeply in debt and
right.
then end up working long hours for very little money, right?
There's a real pay discrepancy between the kitchen and the front of the house. And you know, I don't really know what the answer is. Some people think it's the service charge. I think that, you know, if you have a service charge where something like 20% is added to everything in the restaurant, where supposedly you can pay everyone in a more equal level, it really depends on the house, the management, to make sure that it is structurally equal. And I don't know if that's the answer, but there is
yeah,
a
at
really
the end of the book,
problem.
You bring up this new policy, which is the title, Service Included,
right.
That instead of tipping, the 20% was going to be added. And this was supposed to go to people in the back, right?
Right. And I haven't actually seen the breakdown of numbers, and I haven't spoken to a bunch of people to compare to see, you know, whether their salaries went up. But the issue is really true, and it's a real problem, and it's so unfair the amount of time and effort and energy that people in the kitchen put into their job compared to the service staff, and the, you know, the difference in money is just appalling.
Yeah, because there's certainly star name chefs, celebrity chefs at least people who follow this sort of stuff know their names, but then there's an army of almost line cooks.
Oh yeah.
Tell us about, you know, the division of labor in the kitchen. What's that like?
Well, you'll have the executive chef whose name is everywhere, and then you have usually the chef de cuisine, who's the person who's actually in charge every night. And then you have it really depends on whether you're talking about the really fine dining or every other, you know, lower end restaurant. But you'll have a bunch of line cooks or, you know, commis or prep cooks, whatever, and they work at, you know, really lower levels.
Is it like an assembly line? They're just more or less doing the same thing over and over again?
It really depends on each kitchen. At, per se, each, you know, so fish would have its own chef de partie. So, you know, one person would be in charge of just cooking fish, one person would be in charge of cooking meat. And they would move around a lot, but they really mastered their own station.
But then there's this, one of the signature dishes of per se is this salmon cone, right?
Right, which I try to cook, and it's
yes.
a nightmare. And that is, you know, these little tweels, which are basically like little, they look like little cones, which are impossible to make. And then a whole bunch of salmon tartare and creme fraiche. Basically anything that is made at per se has 5 million steps to it, and it really helps if you have a staff of 50 to help you make it.
Yeah, the menu for the meal that you and Andre, who became your companion at the end of the book, the menu you had after you left was stunning to read. I mean, just
yeah,
like
I really
one ingredient after another, I said, oh my God, I mean, I couldn't even begin. I'm something of an amateur cook, and I couldn't even imagine how to begin cooking like that.
I don't think you'd really want to be cooking like that. No one wants to eat like that every night.
No.
But I did want to include the menu at the end so people could really get an idea of what it's like, what the experience is like.
And it is what Alexander Coburn once called gastroporn, because you just read
exactly.
that and get really excited in this voyeuristic way. And
right.
It's almost, in some sense, a look but don't touch feel to mm-hmm. some of this stuff. Of course, but you were looking and touching every night.
But not eating. No.
Well, there is the so-called family meal, right?
There's the family meal, which every restaurant also has. And some are better than others.
Well, we had that in the college dining hall, too, when I worked. So they called,
you did.
They called it the family meal then, too, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's not off the menu.
Not at all. Occasionally, you know, someone would make a mistake with some really fine ingredient, and we'd get some, you know, Wagyu beef and something. But otherwise, it was, you know, a lot of rice and pasta, pretty basic, simple stuff. Otherwise, the restaurant would have gone broke.
I'm speaking with Phoebe Damrosch, who is the author of Service Included, 4-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter, recently published by William Morrow. Who are the clientele, per se?
It kind of went through waves at the beginning. At first it was just stampede of foodies, and then we had a wave of people who had heard that it was the hottest restaurant in town, and so had their assistants call and get them reservations. And I found that oftentimes those people would get a little itchy in their seats after the first hour and a half because they didn't realize what they were really in for. Occasionally you'd get people who had saved up, who, you know, maybe a line cook at another restaurant who was really interested in learning about the food, or a waiter from another restaurant who really wanted to experience that. And those were always fun people to wait on. And then, of course, there was the, you know, New York elite.
Right. You know, like how many hedge fund top shots would like blow $10,000 into wine? Did you get much of that?
Many. And pharmaceutical companies and, you know, people just who had a lot of money. I mean, we had a bunch of regulars, which really surprised me. I didn't realize that people would, A, want to eat like that frequently and be able to.
Did you get the sense that some of these people were there just because it was so expensive and there was a conspicuous consumption of a sort and that they weren't really appreciating the food or the people?
Oh, yeah. There were definitely, and as I said before, when the runners would come out and explain the food, you know, this is your oysters and pearls and explain what kind of oysters and what kind of caviar and how it was made. Some people would get so frustrated and not want to hear about it and kind of wave us away. And it was clear that, you know, they weren't really interested in what was on the plate. They were maybe more interested in their dining companions, which is fine, or maybe more interested in just kind of having said they had been there.
And I noticed in the subtitle you use the word eavesdropping, and it recurs throughout the book that you actually eavesdropping is part of service, right?
I think it's one of the most important things a waiter has to learn to do, because most people won't tell you what they're really feeling about their food. But they'll tell their friend next to them. So, or maybe even just sort of make a comment about something that isn't clear to them or that is making them uncomfortable in some way. And if you overhear it, you can step in and help. Otherwise, there's no way to really know how they're feeling. And also eavesdropping sort of in a physical sense, if you can watch someone's body language and see what might make them more comfortable.
But at the same time, the customer can't be aware of this.
That's right. You have to try to be as invisible. So, and then, of course, as the writer in me was also eavesdropping, because it's fascinating to watch people when they're not realizing that they're being observed. You know, and a place like Per Se is the kind of place where people come for really important moments of their life. It's proposals and important meetings and, you know, all these big fights, all these things. It's a really interesting place to observe people.
Yeah, there's a chapter which almost, especially the beginning of it, feels like something out of the story of O, about service being the anticipation of desire.
Right.
what do you mean by that?
I think that if usually when someone is surprised by service and pleasantly surprised by service, it's when you have anticipated something that they didn't know that they even wanted. You know, so when they were just thinking, oh, I might want this, then you're there holding it. You know, you're there with the wine list when they need to order another bottle, or you're there, you've changed something in there. You realized in the first course that they actually really don't like raw fish, and so you've changed three courses later, you've changed the dish because you know that they wouldn't like it. Something like that.
And the normal experience is not for people to order things off a menu, but just to sit back and be served, right?
That's great. I mean, if someone just says, I'll have the chef's tasting menu and lets the experience unfold before them, that's great. People who wanted to make a million changes to the menu or had a lot of likes and dislikes and allergies were always a little bit more challenging.
And, of course, one of the highlights of the book is when Frank Bruni of the New York Times comes to do his reviews. And when he visited three or four times, right?
Six times. Yeah.
And
exhilarating, terrifying, six times.
And one time they had, table of four, and they concocted 80 dishes, different
dishes? I was trying to figure out how many it would be, because, you know, he had this really long menu, and the kitchen tried to send out a different thing to each person at the table, all four people. So, you know, which required them to then rotate so that everyone could taste everything. It took forever. But, yeah, I tried to figure out how many utensils they would have used through, you know, 80 different dishes, however many it was. And that was just one meal, and it was really the restaurant's chance to kind of show off what we were capable of.
But
and he had a little bit more normal meals the rest of the time.
The ideal is, of course, that the critic is supposed to be unknown, but you all knew who Frank Bruni was right away, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard. His picture is posted everywhere in every restaurant. So it,
and he wore some preposterous disguise, right, with turquoise glasses.
He tried to wear a disguise, and it just didn't work. We were really pretty tuned in at that point. But he did come in once without our realizing it, and I think it was probably helpful to him to experience it. And he also, I'm sure, sent a lot of friends of his in to, you know, see what it's like when you're not recognized.
But it worked. He gave you all a good review.
He gave us a great review, although he didn't say much about service.
And,
a little disappointing to me.
But service is supposed to be invisible, right?
That's true.
So all your desires are anticipated, and you don't even know it. But he spent something, $10,000 of the Times money on these adventures?
That was, I think you're probably quoting from Sean Wilde's review in the Times.
Yes, that's what
I thought. Yeah. I don't know. I can't speak to that because I haven't run the numbers on Frank Bruni's meals. But yeah, I mean, it's a research job, and sometimes his research requires places like Per Se, and sometimes I'm sure he spends a lot less.
Yes, really.
But people care. I mean, you know, as long as people are interested in reviewers' opinions, then they will continue to matter.
You know, I'm in a project I'm undertaking now is researching the American elite, the American ruling
okay,
class.
This is what I thought we were going to be talking about the whole time. I'm waiting for this.
I'm very interested in the fact that the massive changes that have occurred in this demographic over the last century or so. John D. Rockefeller paid his kids pennies to pull weeds out of the lawn up in Westchester. Now, you know, that kind of austere Protestantism is a distant memory. Now these guys want to be pampered. What are their expectations of this clientele? Do they really expect this kind of massive deployment of resources to make them happy? Do you get that sense that what are the expectations of this crowd? Is this routine for them?
I remember overhearing, this is one of my eavesdropping moments, actually. I remember I was pouring something, and I overheard one person say to another, well, I mean, you have a jet, right? As if they were talking about, you know, like, do you have a DVD player or something? I was shocked. I think that in some ways I didn't even realize the level of it's hard for me to even get my mind around the kind of numbers we're talking about. So I remember sometimes just worrying, am I upselling this person on wine and maybe they can't afford it? And then realizing that I was talking about some, you know, someone that I then found out made multi-millions. So in some ways, like, you know, I think there is an interest in being pampered and sort of luxury to an excessive level. I don't know. I have really mixed feelings about it because in some ways, I came across a lot of people who seem to treat expensive food as some sort of perversity, like, oh my, I can't believe you would spend that much money on food. It's only food. And I think if you think of food as just sustenance, then it is kind of perverse to think about spending $275 just on your menu. If you're willing to think of food as art and travel and an experience and a memory, then it's like buying a plane ticket or a concert ticket, and it feels a little bit different.
But and also, if we go back to the Rockefeller model, where Carnegie built libraries, and Rockefeller or Morgan collected art and endowed museums.
Right.
Now we have an elite that seems just to want to spend a lot of money on itself in very disposable ways. I mean, the meal is gone in a couple of hours. Even at per se, it's a very transient thing.
It's true. Ephemeral.
Ephemeral. I mean, is that part of the beauty of it, I guess, maybe?
If you're willing to think of it as art, then you could make an argument that that they're supporting art, that they become the patron to the chef, and, you know, maybe this is something that should be preserved.
But
it's an argument. I'm not saying.
Yeah, we can all go visit the Morgan Library or the Met, but we all can't go eat it per se, though.
Right.
Now that you've retired from this business, and
right.
are you just a writer now?
I am just a writer, and I've taken a serious pay cut.
Yeah.
And while I was at Per Se, I found myself eating at a lot of these really high-end restaurants because I was really fascinated with the culture, and I had disposable income, and I no longer do that.
Ah, that's what I was wondering. So you miss that world, or are you kind of relieved to be away from it?
I miss parts of the job. I miss the social aspects of the job. I really miss the paycheck. And it was kind of exciting to be treated with have that kind of luxury. You go to other restaurants and have them pour champagne for me. I mean, it was really lovely. But it's not who I am anymore. You know, now I'm no longer part of the club, and now I'm cooking my rice and beans at home.
I guess you could always go back if you wanted to. Right?
I could.
All right. We're out of time, actually. And I've been speaking with Phoebe Domrosch, who is the author of Service Included, 4-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter. A very enjoyable and nicely written book. Thanks for joining us. A book published by William Morrow, for those of you who are taking notes. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on with the evening. And let's go out with this club classic from the early 80s by Nona Hendrix and Material, Busting Loose. Busting Out. Till next week. Bye. We'll be right back.
time.